Well, this is it, the last episode of the season. Hi, this is Thomas, one of the hosts. A lot of work goes into making these podcasts. Each of us has responsibilities for our time, like family and making our games. So when we started, we committed to making 6 episodes just to see how this would go. If this podcast isn't making a difference, then we should be good stewards and do something that will. So we need to hear from you. For example, we started with a 60-minute format, but that evolved into about 90 minutes. Does this matter to you? Write a review on iTunes or post a comment on our website, RadianceGameDev.com. We're going to use your feedback to plan out if we even make a second season. I hope you enjoy what you're about to hear, and thanks so much for listening.
Welcome to the Radiance Podcast, an open discussion on how Christian faith integrates with game development. Here are your hosts, M. Joshua, Michael, and Thomas.
Welcome to the Radiance Podcast. I'm your host, M. Joshua, and today we have an exciting show. I'm with my two co-hosts, Thomas and Michael, and we have a special guest today who's Kevin Shutt, the author of Games and God, a Christian exploration of video games. But I found his book in my favorite bookstore. The host of this bookstore always picks like the best kinds of books to put out on the table. So I was really surprised to find one that was about video games in particular. I picked it up and then I wanted to talk about it to all my fellow Game Church writers. And long story short, here we are 2 years later. Kevin is contributing on Game Church just as much as I am. It's been a privilege and opportunity to get to know him. So Kevin, how are you doing today?
I am great.
And you're coming all the way from Vancouver.
Yeah, just outside of Vancouver, a small city called Langley in the countryside outside Vancouver, yeah.
And now you're also well known for your scholarly contributions. Now you're a professor at, is it Trinity?
University, yeah. We're a small Christian liberal arts school. We got about 3,000 students, and we've been around since 1962, and it's a non-denominational, evangelicalist-oriented tradition with a lot of different faith traditions represented, lots of different people, lots of different voices here, and it's a good place to do scholarship.
I'm really looking forward to having you on the show today. It's a different kind of show than we typically do. Typically, we focus specifically on Christian game developers, their stories, and that sort of thing, and we definitely wanted to get into your story because you've brought a lot of really valuable things to the conversation about video games from a Christian perspective. First of all, Thomas, how are you doing? How are things going up in Toronto?
Hey, things are great. I'm going to GDC.
Oh, nice.
It's been like, I don't know, 10 years that I've been dreaming of going to GDC and finally slapped down the MasterCard last week. I'm going.
Oh, man. I might have to try to beat you up and take your ticket. Awesome. And before you give a little bit of more of an explanation on what our show's about, let us introduce our other guest, Michael Eustavinis. Michael, how are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing okay. I'm actually sick at the moment, so that's kind of a bummer. Okay.
But, how are things in Florida, and how are things going with Heroes of Issachar?
Things are going well, still chipping away at it. No major updates, but things are progressing on it. Yeah, so still excited about that. I am a little bit nervous about the number of Canadians on this podcast. We now no longer have the advantage.
Yeah.
Taking over.
Yeah, I'm just going to have to keep my eye on the border there.
It's tricky all the way down south where you are. I'm a little closer. I'll look out for you. I'll be your watchtower guy. Thomas, you have a much different idea of where we want to go with the show today. How about you explain to everybody what we're going to be doing?
Sure. In our other podcasts, we have been interviewing developers and talking about their games and how their faith kind of intertwines with that. The other way that we can do podcasts, it's not an either or, but the other format is a topical format. Just recently, I finished reading the book Jacked, which is about Grand Theft Auto and how it came to be. And there's just some fascinating stuff in that book. And it just got me thinking about the kind of questions that go into game design about what to include and what not to include. And what's shocking is Grand Theft Auto does not include everything that they wanted to include. So that was a bit eye-opening reading that. But so I thought it would be great as our final episode for this season to take the topical approach, do a bit more of a roundtable discussion, something like you would find a panel-type discussion at a conference or something like that. So that's the idea for today.
And I'm really looking forward to getting into that. Are you the only one here who's read Jacked?
No, I have not.
So Thomas is going to be the one who uniquely brings that to the table. For the rest of us, I really, really want to get into that conversation. But first, I want to build a little bit more of what you guys have been playing, how that's been shaping your thoughts leading into this conversation. And so, Kevin, we're going to start with you, and then we're going to go with Michael.
Constant game over the last few months has been Hearthstone. So I just sort of play a few minutes of that here and there. Recently, just played some Kingdom Rush as well. And I just started this week playing this new iPad game that it's not new, but it's new for me, called Out There, which is a space exploration strategy game. And yeah, I know, Josh, you like that one. it's a really interesting sort of narrative, blend of narrative and strategy. And I haven't really mastered it yet, but it's a very interesting one. Most recently, the one that I wrote about for Game Church just a couple weeks ago was The Marvelous Mistake, which was a theft game, sort of a heist game in the sort of, you know, style of The Sting or more recently Ocean's 11, that kind of stuff. And so that's been a really interesting, I wrote about what it meant to steal in a game. And so that was kind of an interesting thing, and it's given me some stuff to think about.
Yeah, and you had a bit of a head start on me on that one. So I was really thinking about what you had said in the Game Church article about it as I was going into it, really trying to process this. And it's actually surprising because there's a character dialogue in the game. It's like, is it okay that we're stealing things, even if we're stealing them back? And it's like, well, I'm a thief. I'm just going to steal either way. Well, I'm doing this for moral reasons. And they're like, well, you say whatever doesn't keep you up at night and that sort of thing. Yeah. So it's kind of an interesting thing that the game itself is a dialogue on that too. So, yeah. All right, Michael, what are you playing lately?
What have I played lately? I played Mount and Blade Warband. That was more for research purposes. Our game, Heroes of Issachar, has kind of been compared to it a little bit. I can see it a little bit, but not totally. But anyway, I played that. It's a good game.
And Thomas, what have you been playing lately?
Well, in talking to Michael about this topic of kind of choices we have in video games, he said one game he's very uncomfortable playing, even though he loved it, was Payday 2. And I was like, that sounds pretty cool. So I'm going to go check that out. And I've been playing Payday 2 like crazy because probably after today's podcast, I won't have a good conscience of playing it anymore. But but leading up to it, I can call it research. And I've been playing tons of Payday 2. And you know, as Michael had said to me previously, you know, that game puts it very much in your face of just shooting cops like crazy. And what does that mean? Yeah, so it was just really interesting. It's a phenomenal multiplayer game. I can't believe how well they pulled it off. It's very much like the movie Heat. That is one of my favorite movies of all time. And so to play a video game that was able to kind of capture the action moments of that really impressed me.
I've had a lot of personal turmoil with that series, and I've wanted to play it. And I download it, and I look at the picture of the people with the masks, and I'm like, I don't want to be those guys, you know, like that's just my immediate reaction. On the subject of player choice, there's one of my favorite series of all time is the Deus Ex series, which is Deus Ex, then Deus Ex 2, The Invisible War, and Deus Ex 3, Human Revolution. So I've recently been playing, replaying for maybe the fourth time, but I haven't touched the series in like 2 years, or not 2 years, like 4 years, 3.5 years since the game came out, because I just played it like crazy and didn't touch it for a while. But the thing about Deus Ex that is really, really unique is that every other kind of cyberpunk game or military kind of character game is you get a gun because you're going to shoot people. That's the general assumption. Shadowrun is like this. You get guns. You have to shoot people. That's the only way you can win. But Deus Ex, there's always at least three ways to a problem. And every one of them costs something for you, whether that's going to be you trying to get into a conversation, that's going to try to get this information out of somebody, and you have to speak to them just the way that you need to speak to them, or it's going to be sneaking through the vents in the building to try to get into a secret office, to get hack into the computer, to get the information you need, and get out of there with no one seeing you. And if someone sees you, they're all going to either try to shoot you, or it could sully your, basically everything affects as it would in the real world. And that's the consistent ethos throughout the game, is that it affects things like the real world. And you constantly have this question of, well, then if I do have to get into some sort of conflict with somebody, do I avoid them entirely and try to not be seen? Because that's the highest skill thing to do. Or do I shoot them to kill them from the shadows? Or do I non-lethally take them down with some kind of taser or something along those lines? And so as far as the ethics of what you do in a game, that's front and center in the Deus Ex series. So I've just been replaying it, and I should be playing other games because I have other assignments. I can't stop playing, especially considering I have the director's cut, which means I have all the developer commentary. Favorite thing is not only revisiting the game, but being able to hear everything that the designers were thinking going into the scene. So I didn't realize how much thought and detail went into the world building and how much I missed, even the first three times that I played through this game, that the developers had given way more thought and put so much subtlety into it. Any game that offers developer commentary always try that out. That's my advice for the day.
This program brought to you by Warren Spector.
Yeah. So the reason why I wanted to bring up Deus Ex is because, of course, Warren Spector is the director of the original Deus Ex. He has a lot of things to say about the state of games, the nature of play, and he's very outspoken about criticizing power fantasies and games that are just about making people feel awesome and aren't about engendering any kind of thoughtful dialogue or thought to your actions.
Before we go any further, let me just mention that in addition to this podcast, Radiance is hosting a conference February 20, 2015 in Orlando, Florida. This is to help Christian game developers make better games. There aren't any talks to listen to. Instead, you and two other devs will dive deep into your game. This is a great opportunity for real feedback, ask questions, or just brainstorm ideas with other developers. Then you switch and do the same for them. This is an iron sharpening iron type conference. Michael and I will be there, and we did this exact agenda before, and it was super fantastic. It's easy to attend. It's at the Crown Plaza Hotel, and everything is included. Just bring you and your game. And if all this isn't enough, one night we're going to go to a theme park and ride roller coasters. So come to Florida in February. You can get all the details at our website, radiancegamedev.com, and click conference. We'd love to see you there.
Kevin, how about you tell us a little bit about your journey, how you've come to become the Of Games and God guy, how video games have become an important part of your academia.
Sure, okay. Well, just to date myself a little bit, I was born in 74, so I'm 40 years old, and I got my first computer when I was, it must have been like 10. We got a Commodore 64. Ever since then, I have been around video games. They've been a big part of my life. I didn't ever intend to make it part of what I do for a living in any way, shape, or form. It was something that I sort of fell into. But I feel like that was sort of God's leading in my path. But even when I wasn't thinking that way, video games were always a big deal. I mean, I think some of the stuff I remember most clearly from, you know, being in junior high and high school or some of the games I was playing at that time, and college. I mean, we had a whole bunch of us guys who played games together, and, you know, a lot of it was like Magic the Gathering type stuff and things like that, but there was always this steady stream of computer games. I wasn't, by the way, I wasn't a console gamer. I played everything on computers. My friend had a Super Nintendo, and so I got really good at Super Mario Kart and Street Fighter 2, but outside of those two games, I never touched a console game basically until I was actually a professor. But computer games were always a big deal for me. And when I was a teacher too, and I taught overseas in school for missionary kids, we just about, you know, two or three times a week, we'd take over the computer lab and we'd play StarCraft. And that was a way to bond with the kids. And I wasn't that good at it, but it was a lot of fun. So it was always a big part of what I did. And then I went to grad school, and it was kind of funny that the very first day, and I've told this story so many times in public, but the first day of classes, I went to this class, and this professor, who ended up being like really important to me, was just a really good guy, he stood up on the first day of class. He says, you know, you're going to be studying this stuff for a long time, so if you're going to study, you should study something you love. And I very distinctly remember thinking to myself, huh, I wonder if they let you study computer games. And that was it. You know, that was, because apparently they do.
At least one guy.
Yeah. So when that was probably 2000, fall of 2000, and started poking around a little bit. I had some vague ideas of maybe studying film or Disney or something like that. And as soon as I started thinking about this computer game thing, I thought, you know, that's really interesting. That might be an interesting angle. And I poked around, and I found out that there were a bunch of academics, especially in Europe in the late 90s, that were starting to publish research on what video games are like and how we should think about them and stuff like that. And they were coming from a literature background. So they were trying to sort of get their heads around, you know, what is unique about a video game? What's interesting and cool about them? And how do you talk about them in an academic setting in a way that sort of makes sense? And so I got in kind of just above the ground floor, basically. And since then, I've been studying all kinds of different things. My interest has always been as a scholar. I'm always interested in how technology has changed our culture. how it can change our culture, how it is changing our culture, how it opens possibilities for changes, because we don't live and think the same way that people did 100 years ago. And there's a lot of reasons for that, but our communication technology is a big part of that. And I think video games are such an awesome place to study that, because they're such a big part of our new media landscape. It's not the only thing. I mean, there's social media that you can talk about, and just web pages in general. I mean, all of those things have really changed our communication. But video games are fascinating because they are kind of like a movie or a book, in the sense that they're recorded artifacts, but you play with them. You know, it's like you open a book and then you can actually play around with the characters, and that recordedness and interactivity at the same time really opens up all kinds of really interesting possibilities. The metaphor I always use in my scholarship is, when you read or watch The Lord of the Rings, it's kind of like going on a glass tour bus. You can drive through the territory and you can see everything and you can appreciate it. But a video game allows you to stop the bus, get out, and poke at things. And, you know, look underneath the rocks and smell people. And, you know, well, not yet, but we're getting there. So it's a very different kind of experience. And so there's so many things that opens up. And so one of my professors encouraged me to start writing about that and write for the larger church community. And that's where the Book of Games and God comes from. And there's just so many different things that spring from that interactivity, from that play, that I couldn't really write a book that was on a single point. And so every chapter deals with something different. So, you know, there's a chapter on religion and spirituality in video games, on violence in games, on, you know, fantasy and escapism and addiction in video games, and gender in games, on education, on community, on production of games. There were just so many interesting things to talk about, because play opens up so much. So that's really what I'm interested in.
When you said it's recorded, kind of media recorded art that you can interact with, my first thought was Teddy Ruxpin.
Yes. That's old school. A lot of people
that is old school. Put that in show notes for everybody.
Yeah. the little weird creepy bears that when you press the button, it would, you know, hi, my name is Teddy Ruxpin kind of thing. And it's kind of, yeah.
The inspiration for the movie Ted. Don't want to get too far into that. Kevin, I know that you obviously bring this very unique of academia and games and faith into everything. So I personally am really curious about, what is your faith journey in the midst of this? You definitely talked about your academic and video game journey, but how has your story of faith come in to integrate all those things? I'm sure it's all been part of the journey at the same time, but I want to hear more about that, more about you.
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm a Christian from the Christian Reformed denomination, so I'm from an old school Calvinist roots, I grew up, you know, believing in Jesus, and that was always part of my life from when I was a small child. So I went to Christian schools as well, Christian schools that were very open to thinking about the world and you know, engaging the world and not trying to retreat from the world in any way, but ones that were very strongly grounded in a faith perspective. And so I knew from a very young age that God mattered to everything that I did. Like all aspects of my life belonged to God and should be impacted by what I believed and who I followed. But it's interesting, there are certain aspects of life that the church doesn't really say a whole lot about, or didn't anyways. And gaming was one of those things. It was, you know, it was just one of those things that socially people did. But, you know, especially back in the 80s, the video games were pretty simple at that point, and most people didn't give them a whole lot of thought. And it's not until the 90s that you start to see a broader cultural awareness of that. And again, I didn't really think that deeply about it until I really got to grad school and I started pursuing this as a topic of study. And my grad school, University of Iowa, was a great place to be, but it was like most major universities, you know, religion is not something that is really a big part of academic life. But I knew from having gone to Calvin College and from my Christian school education, I knew that, you know, God belonged in there somewhere, and I couldn't quite figure out how to put the two together, this scholarship that where religion is largely irrelevant, and this passion of mine and you know, these games that I think have really important things to say to our culture. And so when my professor suggested working on the book, it kind of forced me to say, okay, so what does God have to do with games, and how do we bring God into our discussion of games? And so the book is sort of my working through of that. And for those who have read the book, you know that actually the book doesn't have a lot of conclusions.
Raises I noticed a lot of, that. Yeah. I was really disappointed. I'm like, I want my $12 back. Thank you very much.
I don't give answers so much as questions. I mean, there's some things I argue in every chapter, but it feels to me like there's still a lot of stuff to work through here. There's just so many things about games that are different and unusual and weird and wonderful, but, you know, moral teachings of the Bible were built in such a totally different communicative environment that it takes a little bit of work to sort of figure out, so how do you apply this or that principle to games? And so there's so many issues that we could look at, but I firmly believe that God cares about video games, that he gave us the capacity to play, and so play is what we're going to see in our media, and video games are just one form of that play.
Awesome. Why do you think play is important? Like, why do you think God built in play?
You know, that's a good question. I don't know if why is something I can answer when we're talking about, you know, the divine imperative. I can say that when I look at the handiwork of God, that I see play all over the place. I mean, you don't have to look far in nature to see play. I mean, just watch some animals for a while, right? I think that creativity is inherently playful when you really think about it. And God is a creator God, and we're made in the image of God. I believe that it would be hard for us not to have some degree of playfulness. Creation is an act of trying things and just seeing what happens, right? I especially think this is relevant to game developers, right? That you may have a particular idea. It's not until you sit down and try things that you know what it is that you have and how it's going to work and what it does. And the act of making things, you can turn it into a bureaucratic operation that's devoid of play, where you say, well, I'm going to have objective X completed by date Y. But in reality, the actual act of creation, even coding, which we often think of as sort of a dull sort of activity for those of people who aren't interested in that kind of stuff, it isn't. It's a very playful kind of activity where you find problems and you solve them. You find problems and you solve them. And you think, you know, laterally and try to find ways of you know, coming up with stuff. So all aspects of life can be infused with creativity, and I think play is a crucial part of creativity. And I got to also be honest, a sense of humor is a big thing to me, and I think that play and having fun and laughing about things, it's kind of hard to separate all of those things. So I think God has a great sense of humor. He made me, after all. So it's something that I see in video games as well.
I've noticed in my two-year-old daughter that play for her seems to be a practice or an exploration of life. And so we have a new baby that's 2 months old. And so we take her to a certain change table and we go, oh, you know, I have such a dirty diaper. And we change her and then we take her away. And then we saw my two-year-old go to the same place with her dolly, put it down, say the same words, and, you know, kind of futz around with the bottom of the doll and then take it away. And it was just so amazing to see that. I've learned so much about game design watching my two-year-old.
That, well, and anthropologists and scholars do talk about that play is often a training ground. Certainly that's the case with young animals, where they're practicing hunting by rolling on the ground with the other cubs and you know, biting each other, but not too hard. And there's the two elements there that's always important. It's sort of trying things, and at the same time, there's always this sense that it's not real in the same sense as normal activity is, right? Because fortunately, your two-year-old was not changing your baby's diaper, because that, you know, that wouldn't have gone particularly well.
Right.
But it's okay, because it's play, right? And there's so many things in life like that. When we play, is a great space to try things, not consequence-free, but with different sorts of consequences.
Yeah. I would pose this as a potential alternative to the term play, because, or sort of a companion to it, because I think that some people might argue that pure play, well, I've seen it argued, not that I agree with it, that pure play doesn't have a place in a Christian's life, that it should be productive and meaningful. And without getting into that debate, that still is out there. And so from a semantic standpoint, what you have described in one way, and the coding example, I think, is a perfect one, but you can apply this to anything. And you see it in the garden. I mean, the very first thing that God had presented to Adam and Eve was to garden. You know, I mean, but like gardening isn't just simply like, you know, having flowers and plants and then just like making sure they're okay. I mean, like you have to get into the dirt. You've got to till the soil. There's work in that. And essentially what it really is, it mirrors the work that God did. It creates order from chaos. You know, a writer has a blank piece of paper and, you know, takes the chaos of words and orders them. A musician with notes, coding. It's the same thing. You start off with a blank piece of paper. And to me, I am one of those guys that sees coding as incredibly joyful. It's to me, it's one of the most fun things that I can do. Most people would call that work. And in fact, I call it work, but to me, it is play. And so that's why I say when I hear the word play, I think, yes. But I guess just for the listeners, I think we should clarify, you know, there's work. There's, you know, when you hear the word work, you don't think of play. I mean, they're almost in one sense opposites. It's like, oh, no, I've got my work time, then I've got my play time. Biblically, however, the line is much thinner than that. There is work. There's vocational work. And yes. But there's also restful work. And I think that is what we're talking about when we talk about play. That is the thing, you know, when you talk about, say, a hobby, you know, or something like that, where, and it doesn't have to be a hobby, but I guess the point is that the line is blurred between work and play. When you look at it biblically, work is meant to be restful. The problem then that we run into is we're not in Eden and we're not in heaven. And so our work isn't always restful. And, you know, we get those glimpses of that restful work. But it's the thing that we still have to accept, that there will always be a bit of frustration in that, because we aren't there yet. We're not in Eden and we're not in heaven yet. The other thing that comes to mind is the Tolkien work that he wrote when he had the writer's block. Does anybody have any idea what I'm talking about? A Leaf for Niggle, Leaf yeah. for Niggle. And so Tolkien was writing Lord of the Rings. He gets writer's block. He just can't. It's not coming to him, and he's incredibly frustrated. And so he writes this short story, and it is basically about an artist who's given the job to paint this mural on the side of this building. So, and Niggle is the name of the character. So he's painting, and he's gonna paint this tree, and all he has is a leaf, and people are like, okay, where's the tree? And all he's got is a leaf, and it's all there is for all this time. And everybody's like, hey, we paid you a boatload of money. Where is it? He's like, I know it's there. But all he gets is the leaf. And then he dies. And so he's traveling. I don't quite remember the details. I think he's on a train or something. You know, and he's sort of reflecting on it all. And he passes this building, and he sees the full tree. And he's like, oh, there it is. Like that's there. It was always there. And so to me, when we talk about our work, we talk about this game, these games that we're making and what we should and shouldn't have in it. And everything, I always sort of think like, yeah, you know, that we're never going to quite get, I think we have in our mind what it should be, but it's never going to be quite there. We get the leaves, but we don't get the tree. And I think that's where sometimes the frustration comes is we want the answer. It's like, should this be in a game or shouldn't it be? Well, we don't get the specifics. That's not what we're given.
And I think that's a spoiler for where I think this conversation is going to go. We're going to be, of course, the conversation is, doesn't matter what we put into a game. And we don't actually have like a concrete answer that we can package up and put into a little tiny bag. But it's very, very important that we wrestle through.
What are you talking about? That's why Kevin's here.
Oh, okay.
I'm very good at giving answers.
Okay. All right. So Kevin, the question for you is, doesn't matter what we put into a game, as we develop it. Why or why not? Go.
Yes, of course it does. if it does, I mean, just the whole act of making a game becomes kind of absurdist if it doesn't matter. I mean, you could put a fish into the game and then call it a game and there we go, it's done. But I mean, that's sort of using the ends to justify the activity, I guess. Yeah, I think it matters because different stories and different mechanics have different impacts. But a part of the thing that's hiding behind that question, the thing that is hiding behind that question is the question of, does the maker of a text, be it a book, a movie, a game, a tweet, whatever, does that maker have responsibility for the impact that that thing might have? I think that's usually what people are thinking about when they're saying, does it matter what you put into a game? And my answer to that is a typically academic, complex yes and no. So if you're asking for the maker has all responsibility for any effects to a text, the answer is no. Or the maker is devoid of any responsibility, they make the text and the player or the reader or whatever bears all responsibility for what they do with it. I think that's also wrong. I think we keep running around this particular question, but in everyday experience, this is pretty straightforward. I mean, if we have a conversation with someone and someone misunderstands something that I say, it sometimes is entirely due to the stupidity of the person listening to me, and sometimes it is entirely due to the fact that I'm an egghead and I say things in obtuse and kind of dumb ways. But most of the time, a misunderstanding is a shared responsibility. I mean, that's the nature of communication, right? We co-create meaning. That's what's going on when we're communicating, right? The maker of an utterance, of a statement, is putting something out there, and the person listening, the interpreter, is trying to make sense of it. And so that symbol in the middle is shared, and we're sort of building it. We're building meaning out of that together. And it's the exact same thing when you're playing a game. The game maker creates something, puts some thought into it, chooses to use cars instead of carrots, chooses to use, actually, I like the carrots idea better. That's a more interesting game. To use marshmallows instead of bombs, chooses to use whatever, and makes the mechanic work this way and not that way. And then the player comes in and totally screws the game up, right? I mean, you probably have seen this before. Those of you who have made games, you know that this is the experience, right? You have this beautiful experience planned, and then your players do something stupid or unexpected. Actually, obviously, often that's a joy, right? That's kind of the fun of putting a game out there is your players do something that you just didn't anticipate at all. It's a both and. They do stuff that you don't anticipate, which indicates that they have some control and some responsibility, but they can't totally make things up, right? Like if I'm playing Mario Kart, I can't suddenly say, you know what, I am not driving a go-kart. I am floating a barge down to the bottom of the ocean. That's what I'm doing right now. Well, the game doesn't give you that possibility. It's just not there. So you can imagine it in your head, maybe, but your actual experience of playing the game is going to be constrained and shaped by what the developer put in. So,
yeah.
So it matters, but it's not everything.
Yeah. And so the thing that comes to my mind in particular, because I want to bring this down to some concrete examples, because we have some that our developers on the show are actually wrestling with. And I think very specifically to Thomas, and we'll come back to some of Thomas's other questions that he has for me. But the one that I go straight to is he's wrestling through whether or not to include like slavery as an option in his game. Yeah. And Thomas, can you elaborate on the questions that you currently have and whether or not to include them in your game?
Yeah, sure. First, to kind of frame the conversation, because I think we kind of skipped over it a bit by just asking Kevin, hey, what's the right answer?
Sorry.
So I love reading books about the history of video games. Okay, so that makes me an ultra geek, right? I'm reading history about video games. I've read Console Wars, Stay a While and Listen about the creation of Blizzard and Diablo and stuff. And then I happened upon this one, Jacked, about the creation of Grand Theft Auto. And we all know what Grand Theft Auto is. Most of the planet knows what Grand Theft Auto is. Grand Theft Auto 5 sold $1 billion worth in, I forget, a week or 3 days or whatever the number is, but 3 days. Yeah. Okay. So it's a big deal in terms of cultural artifact. Right. And so what was so interesting about reading the book Jacked was where does this come from? Where do these guys that are now putting out these basically thuggery simulators, where do they come from? And it's two brothers, Dan Hauser and I forget the other guy's name. But anyway, two brothers. And so one of them, they grew up in Scotland. There was this moment early in the book where it talks about a childhood experience where Dan was in a convenience store in a neighborhood that he knew was gang controlled and he shouldn't be there because he wasn't part of the gang or like whatever. And so so he went in anyway and he put the high score on the video game machine. And as soon as he stepped out of the convenience store, he got beat up by this gang. And so this kind of scarred him in a way and gave him this incredible interest in gangs and movies and therefore games and video games. And so when we look at our culture that says, you know, there is no God and there is no morality and it's all relative, obviously this thinking in video games of, well, it's just a video game. None of it's real. Dan Hauser puts this together and says, okay, then I can do whatever I want, right? Like I see Dan as someone who takes what society's been saying for a while and actually calls the bluff and actually says, okay, like, let's do it, right? So he loves movies like Goodfellas, like Heat, like, you know, most of the Scorsese movies. So those are his favorite movies, right? Scarface and all this stuff. And so he's like, I want to make a video game where I can be Scarface. I want to make a video game where I can be, you know, the guys in Goodfellas and whatever, right? And kind of why shouldn't I be able to? And so you see him starting off with Grand Theft Auto. And what was really interesting there was it was Grand Theft Auto. The first version was created by the guy who created Lemmings. And then he just created this kind of simulated world, and Dan got a hold of it and said, hey, let's turn it into a gangster simulator. And the creator, Dave, is like, well, that wasn't really what I wanted it for. But you know, everybody was convinced that would probably sell more if it was a gangster simulator than if it was just, you know, driving around as a cop. And the original version had you to stop at the stoplights. Like you were like a bad policeman if you didn't stop at all the red lights. So you're doing a car chase and you have to stop at all the red lights. Anyway, so Dan jumps on this thing and he makes Grand Theft Auto 1, then he makes Grand Theft Auto 2. But the graphics really kind of disappointed him as far as his movie-like experience that he could recreate. And so Grand Theft Auto 3 is the 3D version of a gangster simulator. And so it has kind of all these elements that Dan's always wanted. And now it's quite successful, right? And video game design history, like it's a real turning point for this open world game and stuff. And so that's awesome. And then Dan, he just wants more and more and more. And so we get to Grand Theft Auto 5 with, you know, incredible strip club scenes with all this motion capture and stuff. And Dan just keeps pushing and pushing the language and the violence and the all this stuff. And so I'm reading this. And I'm going, okay, so I'm working on my game and I have two paths in my game. I have the good guy path and I have the bad guy path that you can take. So since nobody can play my game right now because it's not done, just think of the game Fable, right? So Fable has like kind of these two paths and some other games do too. And so I need to include things in my game for the bad guy path. I'm thinking, I mean, I have lots of ideas and there's obviously lots of things I can draw upon. But then I think about things like slavery or prostitution as means in which to make money in my game, as opposed to trading or jewelry or art or that kind of thing. And so that to me is an intriguing option. I haven't seen many of those kinds of options outside of Grand Theft Auto, actually. It makes me wonder, as an artist, I'm trying to make these authentic experiences, but where do I kind of draw the line of leading people, having them think things that I didn't want them to think or something like that? Like it starts to become very difficult. And so, and just just to kind of finalize this, so I have a friend who's working on a short story, and it was about the temptation of Christ, and he tells it in a new and different way, and the devil shows up kind of looking like a Justin Bieber and starts tempting Christ to eat with a package of Doritos and stuff. So it's quite a reinterpretation of the story. But anyway, it's a short story that he wrote, and it's pretty interesting. And then the devil uses the F word in it. And so I'm as a reader of his, I'm like, yeah, well, first of all, you're never going to get published in the Banner, which is the Christian Reformed Church, you know, newsletter. You're never going to get your short story published there if you're going to put the F word, you know, in there. Right. So I said, honestly, I don't even want to read that. Like, and so, and he says back to me, do you really think the devil doesn't swear? And I was like, that's a really good point. And it gets to, are these characters being authentic? And so in his sense, he's saying, yeah, the devil does swear. I'm trying to be authentic to that character portrayed within the story. I don't agree with my character's portrayals. And that's what brings me back to my game. I don't agree with prostitution in the real world, right? But is that enough to not include it in my game and stuff? And so that's why I'm just really interested to hear what you guys have to say.
Kevin, one thing that I listened to one of your lectures a little while back, and there's something that you touched on just in passing where I believe you kind of referred to it as playing at evil or trying the evil option, something along those lines. Could you elaborate on that?
I don't know what I said in that specific lecture, but I think there are different ways that we can encounter evil as players. There is possibility of going in and doing bad things in a game for the sake of entertainment. And then there is looking at evil by trying it on, if it makes sense, just to see what it is like so that you can understand it on some level. The example I use in my talks is C.S. Lewis and Screwtape Letters, right? Most people know what the Screwtape Letters is, but just in case, it is a book where Lewis takes the role of a senior devil talking to a junior devil, and he's teaching him how to tempt a Christian effectively. And to write the book, Lewis had to think like a demon. And he was essentially playing with evil in order to get a sense of what it is. And then, of course, he used the benefits of that to sort of reveal some of the weaknesses of people so that we can do something about them, essentially, right? I don't know that there are very many video games that are the equivalent of the Screwtape Letters yet, but I can easily imagine things that are like that. And I do think that even games that are definitely built for entertainment, there is a certain capacity in them for us to sort of play with evil things just to see what they are like in a way that is relatively safe. Now, I say relatively safe because I don't think that there is zero risk there. I think that there is, you know, as a player again, that there is some danger of finding something that's not so good appealing in some way, shape, or form, right? It's very easy for us to justify something that we're doing that we know probably we shouldn't be doing, but, you know, we can come. It's research, you know, like
yeah.
That's, I think that's a legitimate excuse, but it's not always a legitimate excuse.
Yeah,
so I think that, there is a danger, that we, use, that as a justification for something that maybe we shouldn't be doing. But I do think that in order for us to understand things, role-playing, and I don't mean this in the most narrow sense, I mean in the sort of the general sense, playing a role is often a very useful thing. And understanding evil is not necessarily a bad thing for a Christian to be working on.
Does it change anything, the evil that someone might try on or test out in a video game? Really is so far from the actual evil that it is portraying. You know, to buy and sell slaves in a video game is nothing like the horrific experience that it would really be. Killing someone in a video game is nothing like it would actually be in an actual video game. And so on the one hand,
or in real life, yeah.
In real life. No, I'm and so, sorry. Interrupt. Yeah, so does that where does that matter?
It you know, this is a point of discussion, and this gets into stuff that I'm doing my scholarship on, and actually when I have time to really work as a true scholar again, I'm doing all kinds of administrative stuff right now, but my next topic is to talk about how people actually understand the moral and ethical choices that their characters or they are apparently making in video games, right? Because you're right. On one level, shooting in a game is nothing like shooting in real life. And at the same time, there is a connection. And this is where it gets really interesting. The fact is, and you've probably heard examples like this before, I mean, and Thomas even actually wrote this, and it's funny that you used this example because I just used it in a chapel the other day. If you took Halo and you made it a My Little Pony game, same mechanics, right? But instead of running around and shooting the Covenant, you have a sparkle starshine and whatever. And when they shoot each other, little powder dust comes out, and instead of blowing up the alien, you get your opponent to giggle instead, incapacitation via giggling. It's not the same game, right? And it wouldn't have the same kind of appeal. And that says something to us. The fact that we're looking at guns in these games, the fact that we're looking at explosions, decapitations, and, rape scenes, and cheesy come-ons, and, all the rest of that kind of stuff, that actually matters on some level. It's not the same as the real thing, but it's not completely different either, because I don't think... as a communication scholar, I don't think that we can ever totally forget those associations. When we see an image of a gun in Tomb Raider, we think of it as a gun. We don't think of it as random stick that projects a projectile. We don't think of it that way. We think of it as a gun. And so there's sort of a halfway point there. And the question is where exactly the halfway matters, right?
Yeah. So if I may, there's one thing that Thomas brought up before we got into this conversation in his questions. The one was about the game DEF CON, which is, in terms of sheer number, the most violent game ever made.
Sure.
Nuke War. With a click of a button, you are killing 20 million people or, millions of people on a single decision,
the more recent one, the virus game where you play
Plague Inc.
What's it called again? Plague Inc.
Yeah.
Same thing, kill everyone.
Yeah. The difference, of course, is that there's the difference of intimacy. In the sense that within DEF CON, you're of course completely disconnected. As here's just a bunch of symbols on a board. And you decide, do we nuke them or do we nuke them? Whereas, if you're playing a game like Manhunt, and you're specifically getting up on your enemy that you've been stalking from the shadows and then brutally beat them to death, and I can't say because that's not an example that I know of, that I've personally done, but like
Shadow
maybe some
Mordor.
Yeah, Shadow of Mordor, where you've actually developed a rapport with these orcs, and then he might have killed you, and you might have almost killed him, and you go back and forth, and then he has the scar on his face, and you're just going back at him. He's like, you think you're going to hit me with a sword again? Try again, because I got this mask on this time. And, all this context, there's intimacy there. And even though it's an orc and not a human, it's so much more visceral and kind of morally charged than the buttons that you're seeing on the dashboard in DEF CON. So I think that is entirely the question. Maybe it's about... What are the feelings that are stirred up in you as you're committing these actions?
Yeah, and this is why I don't think we can give a simple answer to the question of who's responsible for what in games, because all meaning is generated in a context. There's no such thing as a message that can be interpreted independent of a context, and every context is slightly different. And so what might appeal, in fact, the very same gamer may come to the same game, and I mean, you just talked about this with Deus Ex, right? You discovered new things when you played it through the second and the third and the fourth time. And so the context is different every time you come to it, and how you react to it and how you understand it is different every time. And as a creator of a game, you can't actually predict all the possible contexts and all the different ways that people will understand things. That's not to say that you can't predict anything. I mean, there are certain very reasonable kinds of assumptions that you can make. I mean, when you do a graphic image of, you know, a sniper game where the bullet goes through the skeleton and shows the, you know, the destruction of the skeleton, I mean, honestly, as a maker, do you really think anyone's going to interpret that as, you know, making sausage or, you know, whatever it is that whatever else, you know, benign activity you might want to. There, you know that there are certain things that aren't going to happen, but you don't know everything that is going to happen when players take on your game. So there's no guarantees in anything in life, and that's definitely the case when you're creating a text that could be played by literally millions of different people in millions of different contexts.
Kevin, I got a question. I roundtabled a little bit of this with some non-gamers, some Christian non-gamers. And I asked them about violence in games, and they were initially against it. And so then I said, well, what if the player has an option? So you can either kill someone in the game, but there are also nonviolent options. And they all said, okay, yeah, that, I'm okay with that. And then I said, okay, what if instead of the option being to kill someone, the option was to rape them? They unequivocally all said, no, not cool with that. I said, yeah, me either, but why? Because if two people were arrested for each of those things, the murder would carry a stiffer sentence than the rape. So as a society, we hold one to be worse than the other, even though they're both terrible. Yet one, the sort of visceral reaction for one is absolutely not. They didn't even hesitate. And the other one was like, yeah, that's okay. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think you're making a comment on American culture here. Because I think that in Europe you'd get a different answer. There's lots of discussion in scholarship about how American culture has a different approach and understanding of violence than European cultures. We are so used to gratuitous violence, and it is so suffused in our popular narratives and in our political discussions.
And would you say that that's just as much with you guys as Canadians as us as United Statesians?
I think yes, United States. That's what we call you too, United Statesians. Yeah,
use the secret word.
Yeah. I think that it's Canada is always a sort of a cultural halfway house between Europe and the United States. I mean, our pop culture is mostly American, to be perfectly frank. So, yeah, we're pretty familiar with those narratives. Politically, we're probably less prone to violence, but I don't know if that's because of our politics or the fact that we have a tenth of the population of you. So I don't know, but it's certainly familiar, the whole thing. And I know personally, I'm far more disturbed by watching representations of graphic, especially disturbed sexuality, than I am by graphic depictions of violence. Yeah. And I've been trained that way since I was a young kid. So you know, we have that standard. So I don't know that actually is an indication so much of something about people's moral standards when they're encountering virtual worlds. I think it's more an indication of how we take different moral issues with inconsistencies. I think that's probably the bigger deal there. I will also say, well, no, I think both violence and rape is violent, right? But
yeah.
Violent sexuality, they're both a violation of a person. And so both of them are disturbing in that sense. So I don't know that you can make a distinction on that. Both of them would be, I guess there's, when you shoot someone, there's no expected intimacy in that act. Whereas when you rape someone, there is a kind of good intimate thing that has been twisted in a really unhealthy way. So if you're looking for a justification psychologically for why we would make that distinction, maybe mm-hmm. that's it. But I think that's as close as I can get.
There's one game that I played this past year. Any of you guys hear the game Republic? It's on iOS.
Didn't play it, but I heard of it. Yeah.
In Republic, the first several episodes of the game, I just recently completed the third episode, and in that episode, you do something you never did I've never done in any other game, where you basically have two guards. Typical video game scenario. There's two guards blocking this place where you need to be, and you need to get them out of that scenario, but you have no guns. What you do have is more or less spy software. And you can use the software to go into these people's houses, into the archives, find personal information about them, twist that information, and then publish it in the press. And this was so much more of a violation of conscience to me, especially as kind of like a games journalist or as a journalist of any form, than anything else that I've ever played, because there's suddenly this intimacy. I know that this guard that I have removed, he has lost his wife and daughter in a car accident, because I looked through the things in his house and I found that out. Or I found out that this other guy, his daughter currently has impetigo and his wife is contemplating doing things that she's going to regret because she can't pay the bills. And I know these things because I've been in this person's house and rooted through their things. And so there's this aspect of intimacy. And this is a completely nonviolent game. There's nothing that, well, not completely, but non-lethal game. You can't kill anybody in this game. You can use pepper spray and tasers and stuff like that. But so I walked away feeling like there's this, again, this aspect of intimacy. How close are you to the situation? Wow. And if I may, bridging it back to the, I think the biggest and most tense thing for us as Christians, and on the subject of morality, is sexuality. We as Christians are always, you know, the questions of morality rises and falls on what we do with sexuality in a lot of cases. And so I think of two games that deal with sex. I think of The Witcher and I think of Mass Effect. Mass Effect, basically when you trigger a sex scene, basically you're not going to see anything worse than anything you've ever seen in a PG-13 movie. You might see, you know, removed outer layer of clothing and the two characters kissing, and then it fades away. And then whereas in The Witcher, everything is fully exposed, and then you get a card afterwards, like sexual conquest card in the first Witcher game, which I only know about because of reading. And on only certain situations, But then there's the bigger question, which is super duper weird. An article just came out today from Simon Parkin on The Guardian, which is the title was "Why Sex Matters in The Witcher 3: The Grand Theft Auto of Fantasy Games." And this is coming back to the thing that you said, Kevin, about European ethics on sexuality versus violence. They captured 16 hours. The article quotes the developer as saying, 16 hours of motion capture are reserved purely for sexual movement in the games. I don't see how that doesn't make any sense to me. I don't see how you can have 16 hours of data related to sex that is not going to create an adult only pornographic rating.
I have never had sex for 16 hours.
Yeah, it's such a super strange thing. But there was a specific pull quote about just the fact that there's 16 hours of motion capture data. They did it purely because they need to show that there's a relational closeness between these characters, and it's mandatory. You can't make it through the game without seeing a sex scene, and that's different because
it happens like right early on. Kevin, react to this. Here's the quote: People might think we're putting sex into the opening scene for no good reason, explains senior game designer Damien Monier, whatever. No. We're establishing that your character was intimate with this woman recently in order to plant in your mind that, at the very least, he must enjoy her company.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think there's any number of ways you can go with that quote. I do think that it is fair to say that sometimes there may be justifications for showing things that are morally questionable. I think that that is true. I think in order to tell a story that has true redemptive elements in it, sometimes we need to journey into darkness. I think that that is true. I also think that games and stories like that are not for everyone, and that there has to be some degree of discernment involved with who actually picks up a game or a book like that. I am less convinced that in this particular case that it would be necessary. My appreciation of the Witcher series is based entirely on outside impressions. My impression is that it is a game that, while it may have some serious tones, is not really there's not a whole lot of redemptive material in it. That's my perception. And so you can use these sort of artistic justifications in a bit of a twisted way to justify something. So without having actually played it, which means that I really can't comment with any kind of certainty, I think it could easily turn into just a cheap excuse, right? So while I agree in principle that that kind of defense may actually justify something like that, I don't know that it's true in this particular case. Can I get back to your original question about your own game?
Yeah.
The question of whether we should put slavery or prostitution into the game that you're making. My feeling on this is that I think it's possible. I think that from a Christian perspective...
Done. Run the music.
I think that, you know, from a Christian perspective, from my understanding and from my faith perspective and as I've thought about these issues, I think that it is possible to do something like that. I think that as a creator, you have a moral obligation to think very carefully about how your player could potentially understand it. Understanding, of course, that you can't control that, and you can't control for all variables, and you can't guarantee what is going to be done. To the degree that you think you may cause harm, you look for ways to tackle that harm. If you see that adding slavery in might lead to a kind of easy justification of racism, I don't know what kind of slavery we're talking about, or if, you know, putting racism in might shock people in a way that is actually emotionally damaging, or I don't know, then you look for ways as a designer to deal with some of those problems and mitigate them. And there's any number of tools at your disposal there. I mean, you can, for example, use the mechanics to indicate the downside of slavery, right? So you get some short-term benefits, but long-term social ill caused by that. You don't have to use mechanics. You could use explicit messagery. You could use artwork. You could use any number of mechanics or tools, I should say, that would mitigate some of the harm that you anticipate as a potential from this thing, right? And it may well be that when you do your evaluation that you say, this particular potential for harm, I cannot in any way deal with. There's nothing I can do that will make this better, you know? And when you come to that point, you have to make a decision. Is the overall experience of the game so important that you're willing to deal with the fact that you may be causing your player harm? Or do you come to a point and you say, you know what, I can't do the game the way I initially intended? Maybe that's your other choice at that. But I think before you get to that point, I think you look at your other options. You know, are there ways of mitigating and all the rest of that stuff? I can see all kinds of justifications, I think, in terms of historical simulations, right? So I play a lot of, you know, Civilization and Europa Universalis and games like that. And I think it would be a disservice to our understanding of history if things like slavery were not included in an economic simulation. It's almost like they've been written out of history, which is problematic. But I also think that there's a real danger in a lot of those games because it makes the mechanics combined with the narrative make them all about gaining power, right? That's what the story is all about in those games. And you don't even have an option not to do that in many cases. And so that's a little disturbing. So there's sort of a, you know, a both and kind of thing. I don't think there's a simple answer, but I do think that from a, you know, if I was going in creating a game like that, I wouldn't necessarily write it out just because you're dealing with something immoral. I think that you look for potential harm and you try to deal with that.
One of the best books that I've read about being creative and being a writer and stuff said that as an artist, what you're ultimately doing is creating emotional experiences, right? That's kind of the goal of the art, is to create an emotional experience. And many games make me feel awesome, or they make me feel powerful or whatever, right? So as I'm trying to create that emotional experience in my player, I'm pushing certain buttons, right? Like I push here, I kind of push there, and I'm trying to elicit certain reactions from the player. And so my question for myself, you don't have to answer, is, you know, how do I know when to stop, right? Like is there any kind of thought framework or any kind of reference that I can look to as like this far, no further?
I think there's a couple of things. I mean, just empathy is a big step right there. Trying to imagine thinking like other people, I think, is probably your first step, right? But I also think that anyone who's involved with game development knows this. Test, right? Put it out there and have people play it and see what they say. And if you find consistently that there are people going, oh, that is really disturbing. And, you know, you're not like Dead Space 2 commercial trying to get that gross out reaction, you know, then that says something to you as a designer. And you might not have intended it that way, but oh my goodness, you know, I'm learning something from my players, right?
Or what's worse, if they engage in the slave trade and think that it's like the best thing that they've ever done.
Yeah.
That's the worst part, right? Yeah. I really struggled with putting this in. Yeah, it's cool, isn't it?
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's the...
And the first thing that I think about as you guys are really wrestling with this is it brings me back to one of the best games I played last year, which was This War of Mine. And how once I finally got through all the thick and all the grime and the wondering, like, is the fact that I'm trying to play the game this way going to pay off in the end? I really didn't know. And then at the very, very end, I noticed every decision that I made affected the final outcome of the game.
Yeah.
And so, like, the fact that I let this character steal, even though I felt like that was her decision and not mine, that affected morale and that gave our crew a kind of a reputation. And the fact that I helped out the one person over here who it was really inconvenient for me to help them out and we could have starved to death, that actually was a really positive part of the story. And that meant that this character was able to reunite with someone in the end and not be depressed, you know, that sort of thing. And the fact that they were able to survive and every single part of these decisions has a payoff or a consequence. I think those payoffs and consequences are how we, and the fact that those things matter to the player. I think that that's what matters the most is that when we make those decisions, the game says the fact that you chose this mattered, regardless of whether it was good or bad. The fact that there was a consequence to the good and a consequence to the bad is what I think makes people say, yeah, this is the way that I wove the story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's definitely what my game is about. So, you know, for instance, with the slave trading, so my game, one of the things as a designer that I would like to see come out of my game is the emotional response of regret. And so somebody's play, they play like the typical gamer where they just like grab everything, do everything. It's like, oh, look, cool, I can have slaves. Okay, I start slave trading and all this stuff. And then they get to this point and like, oh, actually, I wish I would have taken a different path. That to me is like the big payoff as a designer. If I can create that moment to occur.
Yes.
And so that puts me in this place where I have to create those options, like again, slave trading or whatever happens to be and stuff. Right. So, so definitely those things within context of consequence.
Yeah. Kevin, do you have any final thoughts? I know you have to get going soon. Do you have any other thoughts before we let you go on the subject at large?
Well, you know, I don't know who listens, who all your listeners are, but I just can't encourage Christians enough to really seriously consider working in the games industry and making a difference in everyday actions, but also in the kinds of games and stories that they create. I don't believe that, you know, there's going to be an overnight change in the industry, that you're going to see everything different, but there's so many opportunities now with the explosion of indie games to really create some interesting stories, to create some alternative communication and to really help create different kinds of meanings than what we're so used to. And that's a real shame that we don't have more Christians doing that. This is actually something that I'm working on at my university, is we're trying to create a fully functioning game development program. And this is a major undertaking that's going to be very expensive. We're going to be doing lots of fundraising for it. And I don't know if it's even going to go at this point. But I want to try it because I want to help young people who are interested in working in the industry to sort of work on how their faith actually impacts the things that they're doing, whether it be in a front office somewhere or in a marketing campaign or as a coder or as a designer. Because I think that we need thoughtful people to be engaging this medium to help it be a redemptive force in the world.
Awesome. Kevin, thank you so much for being on the show. It's been an opportunity and privilege, as always, to get to know you more and to hear your story.
Thanks, Kevin. Thank you. It's really great to be able to do this and to talk with you guys, too. Josh and I have been talking back and forth via Facebook for a long time, and this is the first time we've actually even heard each other's voices, I think.
I've heard your voice a lot of times, but that's just because I'm a creepy stalker.
Okay. It's a really cool opportunity. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Kevin, if people wanted to get to know you more and to follow you in some sort of space, how's the best way to get to know more about you?
Buy his book.
Yeah. I think the book is the best thing. I'm inconsistent with this, my social media presence, just because I'm so busy with my work as a professor. So I do post things on my Facebook page of Games and God, and you'll see me occasionally on Game Church, the Game Church City website. And I participate with Christ in Pop Culture sometimes and a number of other places like that. But probably the book is the best place to start. You'll get a sense of who I am and what I think is important. And I would love for more people to take a look at that. And especially, I think, the people that I would most like to read it are people involved with youth ministries, because I think that's a place where those conversations should be happening really, really a lot. So I don't make a lot of money off the book, so it's not really a call for, line my pockets. It's more I would just love to see some of those conversations happening in church circles.
If nothing else, the book will convince you Fallout 3 is an awesome game.
Yes, there we go. There we go.
A game in which you can do slavery.
Yes. Yeah, there we go. Well, if I leave you with nothing else, there you go.
Awesome. Thanks again, Kevin. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you.
I hope you guys enjoyed our podcast. If you have any thoughts, we would really, really love to hear about whatever you think about our show. Please go to iTunes and give us a 5-star rating if you think that we deserve it. You can also find out a lot more by going to our website, our brand new fancy swanky website, which is radiancegamedev.com. There you can get all sorts of show notes, links to our guests' projects, and also email us any questions that you have or any thoughts that you like about the show. So thank you so much for tuning in, and this has been the Radiance Game Dev Podcast.